This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician.
Jenny hit Austin.
My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
Just want to do things my own way, you know.
Time equals distance.
Saw an old friend of mine just the other day. Complain about some college loans he still gotta pay. Talked about high school and the days that went before, but he said he didn't think they made days like that anymore. No. Saw an old girlfriend that I used to date. She got married back in April, but she said she couldn't wait, 'cause she had a newborn baby 6 months after that day. Said a debt to life is a debt she's gonna pay.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast, broadcasting worldwide in beautiful high-definition audio, or something quite like it, to every corner of the globe, to all the ships at sea, offering freely enlightenment, perspective, and experience in the world of music, business, and so much more. Hopefully giving you that guiding light you need in these foggy, turbulent times. Oh my goodness, it's great to be with you here today, folks. Sweating it out here in Fort Worth, Texas. But inside the cozy confines of Trinidad World Recording Studios here in Fort Worth, it is just icy cold. Where it's always 62 degrees, the coffee is hot. It's always November here inside. I'm always wearing a leather coat, a felt hat, boots, jeans, making music. Well, not really, but something like it. Oh, I learned years ago, it's got to be cold to make good rock and roll. You know what I mean? Even though we do a lot of recording in the summer, which is great. I've been very busy this summer. My goodness. Had Brian Joyner in here a while back. We had our good friend Richard Marshall was in here recording. The Down Home Freedom Band, tracking some stuff. Red Shahan out there in Lubbock, Texas. And so many more. Well, it's always cold here in the studio. Call me, come record here. 817-733-5256. Or shoot me an email, phil@philpritchett.com. What's on our mind today? Well, I'll tell you what. I love reading those history books, you know. History major in college. That's kind of what I thought I wanted to do. I wanted to be a history major. I mean, a history teacher. My best, most influential person in my academic life, the great David Smith, Dr. D. Smith, at my high school. Just an inspiration. You know, you have those one or two great teachers in your life, if you're lucky. And he was certainly one, maybe the one, the most memorable. He taught a European history my senior year in high school. And, man, it was just a ball. Just eating up stories of the French Revolution, Napoleon, all this kind of stuff. Just great, great stuff. So I always love reading history books, you know, nonfiction. And boy, have I got a good one for you out there. Now, this is a big seller, New York Times bestseller, The River of Doubt. Write it down, The River of Doubt. The author's name escapes me right now. I don't have the book in front of me. Jane, it's a woman, I can't remember her name. The River of Doubt. What it's about is, oh man, Teddy Roosevelt. Let me tell you what, I've become a big fan the more I learn about Teddy Roosevelt. Theodore, Mount Rushmore, spectacles, mustache, you know of whom I speak. Man, oh man, let me give you a little background into The River of Doubt, because I didn't know anything about it. My wife had read it, and some other people had referred it, said, man, this is your kind of book, you know, historical, just a history book. But it's written like a novel, just a written like a gripping thriller. Hey, man, let me give you... Of course, Teddy Roosevelt, president, early 20th century. I think he won two terms. Pretty sure he won two terms as president. Before he was a president, Roosevelt, born of a very prominent family, and went to Harvard. Oh, he's this big-time guy. An elite kind of guy. But he was always compelled to learn about the world. He was an adventurer, a hunter, an explorer, a naturalist. He knew every kind of species of bird in the world, all kind of stuff. He was just extremely knowledgeable, read a lot. He was a rancher and a hunter out in the Dakotas, shooting grizzly bears and just all kind of wild stuff. He always sought out a lot of adventure. And the early part of the book talks about his life as a young man, Roosevelt. They said every time he kind of had a disappointment or a setback, he'd throw himself into some kind of an adventure. Indeed, his first wife died young. And when that happened, he just went to the Dakotas, just loaded up a rifle and went out there and hunted and lived on a ranch and did all this kind of cool stuff. He was a rough rider, you know, in the U.S. Army or the cavalry, whatever it was, Battle of San Juan Hill. Man, he was just always just out there shooting guns at the front line somewhere. Teddy Roosevelt. They said a big part of it was his father had not fought in the service. He'd kind of kind of weaseled his way out of it or found a way out of service. And Roosevelt said, man, I was always a little ashamed of that. You know, oh, did your dad serve? He's like, no, he didn't. And he was always kind of explaining to people why he hadn't served. And Roosevelt said, man, so I didn't want that to be me. I wanted to serve, be proud of my service in the armed forces. And he also instilled that in his children to always serve and fight. He's a fighter, man. Well, to that end, he's president a couple times. He did a few small things like, I don't know, build the Panama Canal. Pissed everybody off in South America, or a lot of people anyway. You know, they called him an imperialist. You know, you've heard walk softly and carry a big stick. That was Teddy Roosevelt who said that. But what happens is he runs for a third term. Back then when you couldn't just run for two terms. He runs for a third term. He has a falling out with his own party, so he forms his own Bull Moose Party. Actually, he starts running as a third-party candidate, and he gets shot at this speech. He gets shot. This dude just fires a bullet into his chest. It goes through his spectacle, whatever he had in his pocket, like his breast pocket, his spectacles, his book, into his chest. He gets up at this rally, and he still delivers a speech with a bullet in his chest and blood all over him. He says, it's going to take more than that to kill a bull moose. And that's how he became the Bull Moose Party. Just crazy, man. I'm just like, good grief. So, Roosevelt gives the speech. Well, man, he's soundly defeated in this election. And it breaks his heart. So, as he always does, after a little setback, he looks for a new adventure, a new beginning. So what does he do? Well, he gets invited by, I think it was the government of Chile or Argentina somewhere. They said, well, man, we'd like you, President, to come down to South America and go on a... Make some speeches at some universities and stuff like that. So he accepts. So he goes down there, but he doesn't just want to go down there and make some speeches and things. He says, man, what could I do down there to explore the country? And he discovers that there is, of course, in Brazil there, in South America, you've got the Amazon River. You've heard of the Amazon River? Gigantic, of course. Well, man, there's just all these, you know, little... tributaries and rivers and streams coming off the Amazon River that go deep, deep, deep into the Brazilian wilderness. And a lot of it, the Brazilian wilderness, just so thick with jungle and, man, still native tribes in there, cannibal tribes, just stuff that people never even, you know, white men had never even seen in their life. Well, he gets hooked up with this general down there, Rondon, R-O-N-D-O-N, this legendary Brazilian general from the jungle, who was responsible for putting up the first telegraph wires through the deepest, darkest forest of Brazil. He was famous for being a tough guy. Rondon, he'd push his men and his troops to the absolute limit. Man, a lot of them died of malaria and all kinds of awful stuff. So, Roosevelt hooks up with this guy. This guy has found the headwaters of a good-sized river right in the middle of the Amazon. But he doesn't know where it goes, like if it goes all the way to the sea or if it hooks up with another... tributary, or if it goes all the way to the Amazon River. It's just an He followed it for a little while, but didn't know where this river went. So Roosevelt, he was first going to travel down the main Amazon River just kind of for fun. But he's like, well, everybody knows what that is. I want to discover something new. Put something on the map that's not even on the map. You know, just like Columbus or something, you know, just a explorer. So that's what he does. He gets this team together. He's got like 100 oxen, you know, and 70 men or something. They pack up. Rondon takes them to the headwaters of this river. And they're just going to put in a bunch of canoes and just float down the river and just see where it goes. They're going to map it. And let me tell you what, man. It is just a riveting story of the harrowing adventures these guys have. It is just unbelievable. They get in this water, just piranhas, anacondas. They can hear Indians and people in the bushes around them talking and making noise, and they see signs of them, and they're scared to death at night. Dude, the bugs, the description of the bugs just in their face and their eyes and crawling in their ears and biting them, and the mosquitoes. It's just, I mean, they'd all kept journals and things. And man, guys, sure enough, quit and defect and start dying and start drowning. There's all these rapids in the river. They got to get out and carry these canoes like through the dense forest. And man, Roosevelt, the whole time, he's just pressing on. He's charting the river, he and Rondon and these guys. But there's all kinds of dissension in the ranks, man. They lose lots of provisions, clothes, food in the river. And it is a hell of a story. I don't know much about it. I guess this kind of took place after his time as president. It was kind of one of his last great adventures. I mean, he was already in his late 50s, I guess, when he did this. And his son Kermit went with him, who was a younger man, and man, you want to talk about brutal? I mean, just the descriptions of the jungle. One of the most eerie things about the book is they're talking about they're going down the river. They got their rifles. We'll shoot some wild game, you know, for food, and just how they're going down this river. There's this huge jungle, thick, but how it's just absolutely silent. They thought they'd be hearing monkeys and birds and, you know, stuff just splashing around. It's just dead quiet. And the reason was, of course, that they were, you know, here these guys are floating down the river. Well, every bird and animal and Indian and stuff, that they can see them out there in the clear river. And these guys can't see but a few feet into this dense jungle. So it's absolutely silent. And they all the guys on the expedition commented on that. I thought that was just so eerie. You know, you're just going through this thick jungle. And you don't hear anything but the insects buzzing in your ear. And they can't find enough to eat, and they lose stuff. And Roosevelt becomes very, very ill and injured. And without giving away too much of the book, man, he, needless to say, barely survives the journey. By the time they get to the end of this thing, he's laying in a canoe, you know, covered with a tarp. He lost like 55 pounds in like 2 months or something just crazy. It almost kills all of them, but at the end of the day, man, they do chart this river, and Roosevelt goes back to New York and has this this presentation and shows where the river is and all this. And a lot of people didn't believe he did it. There's no way he went that far. He went whatever it was, 1,000 miles or something down some unknown river. You know, it must have been already charted, or maybe they got out and quit halfway down. So anyway, it was a hell of a feat, man. A hell of a book. Riveting read, The River of Doubt. It's out there. And my question just reading this whole thing was, you know, here you got Roosevelt. Well, he's the president, right? He was president, shot, Battle of San Juan Hill, a hunter, a rancher, an explorer, a naturalist, a guy who knows how to do things. Yes, he grew up rich. Yes, he went to Harvard. But in addition to that, he did all this great stuff, man. An adventurer, a soldier, a warrior, a leader. My question is, as I look at all these dudes in Washington, they can't figure out what to do, and you know, the budget and the deficit and all these lawyers, all these guys went to Yale or whatever, wherever they went. My question is just, where is Teddy Roosevelt today? Is he out there hunting in the jungle somewhere, you know, with his Ivy League education, but or whatever he's got out there hunting in the jungle? That's the guy we need to find. Y'all tell me if you find him out there, we need that guy to be president, don't you think? I don't care what his political, really, minutiae ideals is, man. Just a leader, man. Somebody who can, man, I don't know. Roosevelt, where is he? Get yourself a Mount Rushmore. If you're Roosevelt or know somebody who is, email me, phil@philpritchard.com. Well, I think I heard our old bass player, J.W. Blue Blue Marshall, rummaging outside in the galley at Trinidad World Recording, trying to find himself a cold beer to come in here and talk with us. He will be in here next. Stay tuned. Mean a lot to me, but the longer I'm here, it seems the less of them I see, and the further I get, seems the longer I'm away. Time equals distance that away. Well, I'd like to think we'd all stay friends along the way. Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchard here on the P2 Podcast from beautiful Trinidad World Recording Studios, broadcasting to you in high-definition audio, or something quite like it. Well, our good friend is here, and my bandmate, bass player, confidant, full band zone, J.W. Marshall is here. Blue, blue, blue.
You.
How you doing, man?
Doing well.
Well, man, we've had some great discussions here the last several weeks. We really appreciate you dropping by, sitting in with us here at the, on this segment of the podcast, opining. God, we talked about movies a couple weeks ago, the Netflix changes there, online streaming, DVDs, etc.
The future of the movie business.
Yes, then we talked about The Great Imposter, of course, our guy Gary Bremen, who passed away. You know, who would impersonate people at the All-Star Game. And we talked about what sports maybe we could get away with getting out there.
And what sports we definitely could not
get away with. Hockey, you know, just yeah. I could wear the pads.
I can't even skate. I've never skated on ice in my life.
But you could sit on the bench. You could walk. You know, they kind of walk on the skates.
Yeah.
Into the box. Put your hat on. Grow you out kind of a mullet, some facial hair. Then during the game...
just come off the ice.
No, you're on the bench. Bite it. You're on the bench at first.
Well, yeah,
and you know when the guys kind of come over,
line change.
Maybe you stunt. You kind of hit your stick on the, you know, like, you know,
I want in.
If everybody else around you kind of jumps up and goes, hey, come on, he's bite. You kind of you know. But then the coach just goes, move. You got to jump over that wall.
Oh yeah,
line change.
You just face plant.
Just a just waving your arms trying to stay up. I'd love it. Just it wouldn't take people long, would it?
No.
How about if you were a hockey goalie?
I could do that.
Patty, but what happens if you just start to drift slowly, sliding
you can't get back
away
to the goal.
From it, and you're trying to get back in the net, but you're just drifting towards center ice? You know what I mean? Just very slowly. Could you turn it around
and
get back to the net?
I think your teammates, once they found out, would probably
beat you
up on the ice.
That'd be the end of that. I'd like to think I could be in the goal, but I don't know, man. I think, not a big skater. I would drift away. Well, here today, man, we're going to talk a little bit about... I finally saw Social Network. You haven't seen it yet, Blue?
I have not seen it.
It's worth a look, man.
I've heard good things.
You know, this
is a well-made movie.
This is last year's Oscars, and I'm now getting around to it. So this is how the world works now.
Yeah.
I got a big filter, man. It's about a year. You know, if an album's pretty good or a movie's pretty good, I better be hearing about it a year after it comes out. Then I'll go, oh, you know what? I've been hearing
maybe
good things.
Maybe I'll check it out.
King's Speech, maybe I'll check it out. Yeah. So I run across Social Network. I'm like, you know what? I've been meaning to see this.
Right.
Loved it, man. The scene stealing Justin Timberlake, man.
Of course.
As the guy who started Napster, just cocky, kind of a partier, but smart, you know.
Right.
Very, very cool. But your man, tying the Facebook deal together, your man John Mayer. You're quite a fan of old Mayer, right?
I'm a fan of the music.
Well, Mayer's like, come on, he's a smart guy. Come on, I'm not trying to. I'm not putting you down
all
here.
Right. I haven't really kept up with him the last
John
couple
Mayer,
years.
John Mayer.
I heard he's gone off the deep end.
Certainly a lot of talent.
A lot of talent. Great
guitar player. But Bob Lefsetz, who I read a lot, of course, talk about all the time, forwarded around an article on John Mayer. He'd given a seminar, some kind of speech at Berkeley. And his big kind of the thing of his speech was the dangers for an artist, for somebody who does something creative, the dangers of publishing yourself. Resisting the temptation to publish all the time, which I thought was funny because when Twitter and Facebook came out, the number one offender in the world of music was John Mayer.
And so who better to now realize?
That's right. So he famously went off, just quit doing it about a year ago,
right.
A couple years ago.
Right.
But man, he was one of the leaders. Like he's got 4 million followers. He did tweets every day. I'm eating an apple. And they were always witty and stuff. And in this article, Mayer talks about it. He goes, man, I honest to goodness would sit there and
edit my tweets and reword it. You know, I only had 140 characters to think, man, is this witty? Should I do this right now? Should I save this and tweet it a little bit later in the evening?
He overthought it.
Well, he just said it starts to consume your creative right. side of your brain. And he just goes, man, it just occurred to me. I was like, wait a minute, shouldn't I be writing songs and thinking, man, is this a cool bridge or is this a...
Right.
And he started talking about the dangers of doing that and really how, he said, just brought him attention for its own sake. It wasn't, it didn't grow his fan base. Now, he had an existing fan base
right.
who followed him, to be sure. But it didn't go, man... He started tweeting all the time. I mean, he's got more fans than ever now. It's kind of like, not necessarily.
Yeah,
true.
At some point, if you're that big, it's really much more of a liability.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's
right,
much more of a
right.
chance to screw something up.
You're right.
If you're
right,
a new
you're
young
a thousand,
guy,
you write 1,000 witty texts right. that just make you look hilarious and brilliant, and you do one that's maybe a little blue, a little off color, maybe it's offensive, and man, you're toast. Yeah. All of a sudden, you know, you can lose people.
And they're having a lot of problems in sports now with these athletes that
right.
you know
say one offhanded thing and
exactly,
yeah.
and they're just tweeting right after the game. Their emotions
yeah.
are running high.
That's what occurs to me about
their
it.
Their handlers are not there 24/7.
You
know,
far
the
more
phone is.
You have far more to lose than the game.
Exactly.
Like I've got a humble number of people following me on Twitter. Bless you all out there. Thanks for following
That's
me.
Right.
I'm not real active on it. I just say like. Yeah, we're playing
shows coming up, yeah.
And I hate using it for that to quote unquote be selling. But I don't tweet about you know what I'm you know man this is I just got a new rug in my office and take a picture of it. You know I'm just kind of like
I would unfollow you instantly.
Yeah, I just say Firehouse tonight. Look forward to seeing anybody. Just for the person that maybe is driving around going, oh yeah, that's this weekend. Cool,
right?
I'm going, or they just might see it and think cool.
Right.
And I kind of do the same on Facebook.
I think it's got to be newsworthy.
To people who want
to
follow me, exactly,
yeah.
And so that's kind of how it seems to be the most useful. But man, these bands just that their sole focus is building a huge online sphere of influence.
Right,
man, we're just adding people on Facebook. We got a huge Facebook. And they have like one album, you know, that's not very good. I'm kind of like, man, you probably need to concentrate on your music maybe a little more.
Need to get over here to Trinidad World Recordings and make a kick-ass album.
You're a businessman, Blue. You're
I
out
am.
There in the business world. Savvy.
I'm
technologically savvy, right? And here's my question. I saw Social Network. It's a very entertaining ride. Of course, Mark Zuckerberg, you know, nerdy, sort of jerky guy from Harvard, starts Facebook. The story's about how he may have kind of stolen the idea from these other guys at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
Who end up suing him, and you know, he turns it into this huge deal, and the ramping up of Facebook, it's an undeniable situation we have.
Right.
My question is the same.
It is a force to be reckoned with.
It is a force to be reckoned with. But my question remains, if everybody has it, and everybody can do it,
mm-hmm.
and it's free,
yes.
what is its real value? I know it has some value. But they're talking about Facebook going public here,
mm-hmm.
An IPO, and they're like, man, is it going to be valued at $100 billion, which is just, you know, astronomical.
Right.
And it just what is that based on? You know more about the economics of technology.
Right.
I can look at Apple and say, man, they make an iPod. Everyone loves the iPod. They cost $300. Everyone has to have it. They make a new one every year that's cooler than the last one. Everyone gets rid of their old one, buys a new one. I see the business model.
Right.
Thrilling products, great technology that works, that's usable, that's compatible, that has all sorts of perks that go along with it, from apps to usability to iTunes to, now you got apps where you can text for free, you know, through Apple. Just all, I'm like, man, they've got it all figured out. They got their own – they're building their own orbit
right.
of value, of products, right. of asset, of innovation. And I'm not saying Facebook wasn't an innovation. We're going to make a website where people can meet up with each other.
Right.
But I don't see the assets they own, the ongoing value of a free use website. Everyone keeps saying advertising, but that's kind of vague. I don't know.
Right.
Help me out.
Well,
100 billion, really?
I don't think it's worth that. But I will say that it is interesting to compare, you know, the MySpace phenomenon with the Facebook, and then also with the sites like LinkedIn.
Yes.
Now,
yes,
the interesting
yes.
thing about those three, you know, is
You've used all three. Yeah, I have too.
And MySpace seems to have sort of run its course kind of early.
Uh-huh.
And as far as generating ad revenue, it was mm-hmm. very tough on MySpace because it's there's not a whole lot of demographic information to target a message at folks.
Right.
So it's a very shotgun scattered approach.
I see.
Which means as a marketer, I'm not going to give you a lot of dollars because I don't know where those are going.
Mm-hmm.
Now, LinkedIn has done a phenomenal job. Because they have a very concentrated population that uses it for business networking, for finding
right.
jobs, for finding business partnerships. So they actually get about 72 times, last I checked, the ad revenue that a Facebook or a MySpace would, because there are certain businesses that would pay a lot of money to be involved in that realm of business people.
Do you use LinkedIn?
You could find a CEO.
You use LinkedIn a lot?
Find a, yeah.
See, I get...
It's very business-oriented.
See, I get asked to join. I add people, but that's all I hear of it. I'm just kind of like, I don't think it's as big of a deal, but if
you're looking at hiring someone or looking for a job...
Consulting projects,
et cetera. Consulting projects, collaborating. Hey, I need to find a graphic designer. You know, you can find business resources there.
I see.
You can use your friend network to... then see their friends that may be in the business.
But how do you copyright something like that? I mean, how can how do you keep someone else from, how do you keep Google or Facebook from going like, oh yeah, we got that, we're going to start doing that too?
Google's coming out with a Google Facebook thing.
I mean, it's good, I'm just kind of like, I know, but it's, the idea is so broad.
Right.
That it's not, you're just not, it's not like inventing the iPad.
Right.
It's not, you know. But you're talking about valuing Facebook as much as Apple Computer. I'm just kind of like, you got to be crazy. Or on that trajectory.
Right.
As coming out of an IPO. And I'm just like, I just don't see it. I mean, it's a fun site.
And everyone
knows what it is, but I don't know what the value is.
And I think that's where Facebook comes somewhere in between.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Facebook has done a great job of giving its user base the tools that they want. Now, sometimes they push the envelope and they get some pushback, but it seems like every time they've done that, it's worked out for them, where they've pushed their customer base in the right direction, even when the customer base didn't want it.
Like with the news feeds and that sort of thing, when that first came out,
everyone was very against it, and now everyone takes it and they love it and they see what their friends are doing and it makes sense and it's a big thing for them. So I feel like MySpace hasn't really – they've always been a step behind Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been too broad and there's no real – it was great for bands for a while and then it kind of phased out. Mm-hmm. Whereas Facebook seems to have a lot more runway. They seem to have
uh-huh.
– they seem to manage themselves well, take feedback, push the envelope. They seem to be as close as you could be to a Steve Jobs and Apple Computer, business model, but at the same time, you got to think there's going to be a million competitors. There's going to be,
but
so really, it's a first to market kind of quality thing, kind of like Google is the best search engine. Anyone can make a search engine now, why is Google still the number one? I think Facebook's in that same area.
But people need to search for things. I mean, I use Google 1,000 times a day. Everybody does. But Facebook, I mean, when you first was going on, I was on it a lot, checking up on everybody. But after a while, you've got everybody signed up, and your interest just wanes. You're just like, man, I've found all my buddies that are on here. I don't know. And you just get tired of looking what they're
right. What
you're tired of looking at pictures of their kids or something. I mean, occasionally it's interesting, I guess, but I mean, it just seems like it runs out. There's just no long term.
Right.
I mean, if you bought stock in Facebook, what do you think it's going to...
I wouldn't buy stock in Facebook.
But
I think with the younger generation, they're much more active on Facebook. I think the older generation picked it up a little late in the game. They got one. It was cool for a week or two.
They
found some friends, and then they got bored with it, and they moved on because Facebook wasn't really built for that population.
Right.
Now, it's great that a lot of older people have gotten into it, and they can keep up with their kids and keep an eye on them, what they're doing.
Much
to their chagrin.
Right.
But I think the younger generation is on it every day, and they're communicating. And it's just a different communication style for the younger generation. They're used to just multiple contacts of tweeting and texting and being on Facebook and updating their statuses and all that stuff. And I think I fall a little in the middle range there. I'm not a younger guy, but I'm not, you know, old and right. tired of it. So, I check it once every, week or so. You know, see if I get any messages or, that sort of thing.
And
I think everyone
uses
it.
I do some business through there. People find me and they'll say, oh, man, we want you to come play our party or something like that, and I'll get back to someone.
It's not a bad deal, but it's just not for everyone. But there is a big population that are on it every day, and there's a value in that, in those eyeballs being there. And I think Facebook has enough demographic information that, if you were, going to try to promote a show in Corpus Christi, perhaps, on August 13th, live recording.
Right.
You could take out some Facebook ads in, the area.
Sure.
And they may pop up there, and somebody may see that, recognize your name, and, that's a way to get in front of people. I wouldn't waste my time with MySpace or a LinkedIn or something like that. So I think it does serve, some purpose. And I think Facebook has now gotten so big that a lot of people have, they got 1,000 friends now, and now they're actually trying to rein it back in to a small universe. And they say, I got a little crazy with it. And if I weed out the friends and maybe get down to 100 people that I really care about, or 50 or 200, everybody's different.
Yeah, every time you check,
then it kind of puts it back into the context of being a usable medium for keeping in touch with people that you want to keep in touch with.
Right.
So I actually have quite a few friends that pose this question.
What's that?
Just how and when do you defriend people from Facebook? So the example is you have a friend that maybe it's an ex-girlfriend or something.
Yeah.
And they're marrying someone else and you've never met the guy.
Yeah.
Maybe you shouldn't be friends on Facebook anymore.
So how do you do that? Do they know?
You can easily defriend them, and they don't know that you've defriended them.
How can you do that?
That's just the way it's set up.
Oh, okay, okay.
If you defriend someone, it does not notify them.
I see.
Now, if someone only has 20 friends, they may realize that now they only have 19. But most people have, a big enough number of friends, and they're always adding that you can,
interesting.
unfriend someone. But I have a lot of friends that have sort of done a Facebook overhaul, kind of a house cleaning. Okay, it's gotten out of control.
Who is this person?
Now there's so many people in the news feed that I can't see what my actual friends are doing because it's a bunch of crap.
That's what I've got. I mean, I sign up all of you great fans out there. Thank you very much. And but man, I always say it, they're not signing on to follow you. They're signing on so that you will follow them.
Right.
They want their thoughts
expressed.
Yes. Now, in the old days, me, Phil Pritchett, philpritchett.com, you just had to follow me.
Right.
I had an email list. I had a forum on my website. Hey, Phil, great show last night. And every now and then I'd go and I'd comment underneath it. Thanks a lot, man. And the more I did that, the more comments I got. Because people would see, oh, he reads this. But there was obviously no way for anyone to have their own picture on there or to talk to other fans or something like that.
Right.
But for me as an artist, that was just fine.
It's kind of
like the old record labels. It's kind of like the old record labels we were talking about last week or whenever that was. I controlled the whole. If someone wrote a comment I didn't like, I just took it off the page. Right. I just went, Phil, you suck. Just take it off. But it was fun for me to go and people would air out all kinds. I'd put out a CD. There might be two or three long-winded reviews on there. Phil, got your album. I know a lot of your fans read this forum. I mean, it was just a page on my website, and what was cool for me. I mean, I was a public entertainer. Man, I'd go to that thing every day, several times a day, and read comments. And this dude posted this big review, and the band's like, "Man, that review that guy wrote, that was pretty cool." And I think that was that guy we met in Lubbock, isn't it? Yeah, I don't know. But it was a cool thing to check out, and it was very useful to me in my career to interact there and read what was going on. But man, now everyone has that for themselves, and I just don't get a lot of feedback from fans specific. Now they'll say, "Hey Phil, great job," or I'll say, "Playing in Corpus Christi, yeehaw." I don't get that.
Right.
And maybe that's the moral of the story, is I'm not a aloof, maybe musician or something. They're not aloof, kind of far off in a special place. We're all just kind of down in the pit together, and
well, and I think a lot of it is similar to the volume of movies, the volume of albums.
I'm
and
talking about
songs.
Back,
now the volume
it was
Facebook,
incredible. PhilPritchett.com. It was amazing that I had a website with my name on it. It was people were just
And you were one of the only places to go.
It was very rare.
You could go to a handful of websites.
And get information on me all the time.
To get information and to post. And now...
Right. This is like late 90s.
Right. And now everyone is posting on... They have 100 different places they can post their thoughts.
I can't get anyone's attention now.
They can put it on their own Facebook page, someone else's, they're blogging. Every once in a while they may write something, but you know they're not going to be all over it. And it's really funny to tie it all in as a marketing consultant.
Right.
Similar to John Mayer, you know, you know, spending too much time. You know, a lot of times when I consult with companies, you know, they'll say, well, we got to have a Facebook page. We got to use social media.
Yeah.
And a lot of these companies, my first recommendation is no, you don't.
Yeah.
It's not for everyone, and you have a lot of other pressing marketing issues that are going to make a lot more impact.
Right.
And like John Mayer, you're being distracted by social media.
Right, exactly.
You know,
it's
now if you have everything else running well, it can maybe be the cherry on top, you know. And for some businesses, it is very helpful.
Uh-huh.
But by and large, you know, people are doing it just to do it with their businesses. And I'm sure a lot of bands do it just to do it.
They like saying it.
Right.
God, I went to
check out our Facebook page.
We're on Facebook now, Twitter, okay?
Yeah, we're big.
Like we're worldwide. Yeah. I mean, we're just – it's huge now. We're on Facebook. I'm just kind of like, who –
But it's funny because they just feel very
pressured. The older guys kind of say that.
But a lot of them feel really pressured, and so I'll meet with them for a first, you know, consultation. I'll say, you know, really, I don't think you need to do that.
You know what I'm thinking,
there's
Jay?
There's a sigh of relief.
Yeah.
They're like, really? Okay, good, because I didn't want to do it. And I didn't – it's like, you know, you can have some minimum presence to say you do it, but you don't have to rack your brain and distract yourself from your business.
I go like the mail place, the place where I mail letters. Just we're now on Facebook. I'm like, who's following Facebook, you know? Or you know, Albertsons, just, you want to follow us on Facebook? I'm just like, why would I do that?
If you have no idea what you're doing. It's just,
I know. It just makes me – so when I'm typing my, hey, come see our live album, it's just with this sort of sigh that's defeated. So, I mean, maybe a couple people see it. Well, you're just – you know, you're just one of a
billion things.
Teams of billions – of little digital deals. Whereas I used to put a little announcement on my website back in 1999 or so, you know, it was
a big deal.
It caused a stir because I knew our 100 fans or whoever, how many there were.
Check every week.
Went there and would see it and we'd have some sort of impact from it. And now who knows?
You just don't know.
These bands follow me, but they're not following what I'm doing. They're posting something every day.
Right.
You know, 9 more days till our gig at Woody's, you know, I'm just, oh God, you know.
Yeah. And there's been a lot of laughs back on that, too.
Well, I'm just like,
the overposting.
You know, I just...
It's a fine line.
It's a fine line, man. But I don't...
If you need a trained professional to help you navigate the world of social media...
Maybe Prince was right. He took down his website. The internet's dead, he said.
Yeah.
Maybe he's right.
You
I hope
never
he
know.
Is. Well, J.W. Marshall, Blue has been here talking about social media. It's just something we always come around to. You know what? Because it changes. It's panache in the market. It's influence. It changes all the time.
Right.
One minute, Mayer's just all about Twitter. Then he's just going, it's a big waste of time. Whoa, hey. Well, you know. I mean,
it
just changes. I'm always astounded. These Conan O'Brien and someone's like, go follow him. He's funny. And follow Steve Martin. So I signed up for him. They tweet like every 30 minutes something hilarious. I'm like, surely he's just got someone in his office.
Just writing.
Coming up with one-liners. I mean, there's no way he's doing that. Why the hell would he do all this? He's not benefiting from this.
Yeah.
Is he?
I don't know.
Maybe he is.
Maybe he is.
Oh, geez. Well, that has been a little social media talk there with Blue. Well, well, well. Thanks for coming in, J-Dub.
Glad to be here.
Oh, good, good, good.
See you in a few months.
Yeah, see you in a few months. He'll be back. We're going to stagger over to the vault here, listen to a record. Hold on tight. Next. Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast. Don't you know, folks? Phil Pritchett and the full band is always for hire for you fans out there who want to see the band play. So just call us, 817-733-5256, or email me, phil@philpritchett.com. We'll come play for your birthday party, barbecue, anniversary, huge festival in your town, or whatever's going on. Whether it's me and a guitar in your living room or some gigantic stage with me bringing a horn section, we do it all. We do it all for you, the fan. Hey, man, it's hard getting out to those bars at midnight. I know how it is. So if you want to see us play at 7 o'clock out on your ranch, get some buddies together. Round up a few bucks and a few beers. We'll show up and play. Email me, phil@philpritchett.com. Well, we're going to listen to some Zeppelin here in the vault. Their last album, their last recorded album as a band. They released Coda and some other stuff. This was In Through the Outdoor, not considered one of their strongest efforts. Oh, man, at this point, 1978 or 9, you had John Bottom, the great drummer, was having a hard time. Alcoholism. This was recorded shortly before his death in 1980, I believe. So this is the last studio record. They recorded it actually at ABBA's studio in Stockholm. Kind of odd. In Stockholm, Sweden. Polar Studios. And so recorded there. And they say that really with you had a rock star deal going on. You had John Bonham, alcoholism taking its toll on him. And then you had Jimmy Page, the great producer and guitar player for Zeppelin, battling with heroin addiction. Rock and roll in full bloom. So you did end up with bass player and keyboardist John Paul Jones and vocalist Robert Plant. They sort of took the reins on this thing. I think they recorded a lot of it themselves, without the other two guys there. So the album is a little more, it's a little shorter, it's a little less full and bombastic as you'd come to be accustomed with Zeppelin. But it's always been one of my favorites. The couple of songs on here are a little lighter, a little, not really something you'd expect from them, but some tunes that I really like, man, like In the Evening. We started off this segment with Cool Stuff, and also I really love this one. Sort of a rare sort of just lilting ballad from Zeppelin here with All My Love. I love this song, man. A lot of Zepp heads hate it, but I'm a Zepp head, and I love it. All My Love, Zeppelin. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. Years later, Jimmy Page would say, "Ah, let that red eye song, you know, all my life, isn't it? I won't go there with in the future." You know, he didn't want to do a whole lot of that kind of thing, which I understand. But I tell you what, man, I love it. I love it. Da da dang, 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 dang, doo. Zep, man, in through the outdoor. This was written at a tumultuous time in Zeppelin's career. We talked about the drug addiction. But, man, Robert Plant had a young son die right before this record was recorded. So we said that's why the album, just lyrically, kind of had more of a somber tone to it, not as much boogie-woogie, hip-shaking rock and roll that they were accustomed to. So it had sort of that kind of vibe to it. It's a little bit of a sad album, looking back with the troubles the band was having and the loss of Plant's son. Also, interestingly, it was at a time in Zeppelin's career where they were tax exiles from the UK. You had the Liberal Labour Party had been in power and invoked and imposed a lot of taxes and wealth distribution. And I mean, the Rolling Stones and Zeppelin, all those guys in the 70s had to get out of the UK. So they all lived in, like, you know, Brazil or the United States or somewhere as a tax escapees. So over there, they just take all your money in the United Kingdom. So these guys were scattered all over the world. They had castles somewhere else and couldn't spend more than like 180 days or something on UK soil, or they would be taxed into poverty in the United Kingdom. Well, so Zeppelin out there dodging the tax, man, getting over a lot of rough stuff with the band when they made this record. But they did a little boogie-woogie on this one off this album from Into the Outdoor. This is Southbound Suaves.
Yeah.
Southbound Soiree. Southbound Soiree, Led Zeppelin in through the outdoor. Right before the tragic death of John Bonham, Jimmy Page on heroin, not making it to the studio. All members of Zeppelin exiled from the UK, recording in Sweden at ABBA's studio in the late 70s. Ah, a tumultuous time for the band, but they got a few gems out of it anyway, as they are always wont to do. Well, thanks for listening today, folks. On the P2 Podcast, Phil Pritchett here. Remember, come record here at Trinidad World Recording Studios, whether you're a pro, whether you're an amateur, you just got a few songs together, you want to put something together, we do all kinds. Give me a call, 817-733-5256, or shoot me an email, phil@philpritchett.com, or just send me that hard drive of those tracks you recorded in your garage or some other studio. We'll mix it here. I'll add a little keyboard, guitar, vocals, percussion, whatever you want on it. Master it for you. All different stages of audio production here at Trinidad. We're here for you. Just let me know what you're trying to do. Well, my thanks to J.W. Blue Marshall for coming by the studio again, talking to us. It's been just a pleasure having him around. Always got a little perspective, a little thoughts on what's going on. We look forward to having him back here in the near future. Well, that is our show for this week. Join us next week, folks, on the P2 Podcast. Have a great week. Much tougher.